From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight's program is coming to you from our home base at the Radio Hall of Fame at the Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Chicago Cultural Center. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. And in addition to talking politics, we will be talking about the politics of media, as we frequently do on this program. For the next hour, this recorded edition of our program will bring together three people who care an awful lot about television and have contributed a great deal to it. And again, we are very pleased to welcome on this the 10th anniversary weekend of the Museum of Broadcast Communications here at our home base, a member of the museum board and one of the true living legends of television, Steve Allen. Steve, thanks very much for being with us. Steve is a member of the Television Academy Hall of Fame, creator and star of many classic television shows, including the original Tonight Show on NBC, the Steve Allen Comedy Hour, Meeting of the Minds, the Emmy Award-winning PBS series, the author of 48 books, including Wake Up to Murder and But Seriously. He is a composer of over 6,400 songs, including This Could Be the Start of Something Big, Picnic, Impossible, and Gravy Waltz. And in deference to our other guests, I will stop the introduction at that particular point.
I'll be running along.
Also with us tonight, we welcome Dr. Horace Newcomb. He is the editor of the Encyclopedia of Television, a massive three-volume work on the history of worldwide television, which includes over 1,000 original essays from more than 350 contributors from around the world. He is the curator here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications and a professor of communications at the University of Texas in Austin. Also with us is an old friend, P.J. Bednarski. He is the editor of Electronic Media. That is the influential weekly business newspaper of the television industry, a former TV critic for the Chicago Sun-Times, the original TV critic for USA Today, also working for the Cincinnati Post and the Dayton Journal-Herald in his earlier days. And I would like to thank you for joining us on this at least historic weekend for us here at the museum. I'd like to begin, PJ, because we're going to be talking a lot not only about what is on television, but why things are on television. And I'd like you to give us a brief assessment of who you think are the regular viewers of television these days.
Well, I think the regular viewers of TV, perhaps now because of cable, have changed a little bit. I think that there are now viewers of television who were the irregular viewers of TV in the past, because of specialized TV or cable channels, that there are now people who are picking or getting onto TV who would have never normally watched it very much. But the typical viewer of television is pretty much everybody. I think the heart of what they would like to have as the television viewer is the 18 to 49-year-old, and the 18 to 49-year-old woman is the person that television most covets from an advertising perspective.
Is there a place for everyone? Can they find something on television, Steve Allen? I mean, if you're the brightest person on the earth, or if you're an absolute imbecile, is there something for
you
on
both
TV?
I am at various times. I think there is something for everybody.
Is that good?
No.
Why not?
Well, the dummies should be taken away and put aside. Unfortunately, they drag down seriously the quality of fare that more discriminating viewers might enjoy.
Do those discriminating viewers, do they have enough to service them by watching either public television or some of the upscale cable channels?
Well, you can never have enough of a good thing, so the answer is probably no. But on the other hand, the more discriminating viewers do a lot of non-viewing. They will do such radical things as reading books or going to museums such as this, for that matter.
I believe that one-third of all the television viewership is done, two-thirds of all the television viewership is done by one-third of the potential audience. Mm-hmm. I think that's correct.
Horace, once upon a time you were a television critic also for the Baltimore Morning Sun, and then you have been studying it for the last 20-plus years. There's been a lot of criticism of television. Is most of it worthy?
Most of the criticism or most of television?
Both.
Yeah. The criticism leaves something to be desired, I think, too often. But and much of television does as well. I think that my view is that 90% of almost every human product is fails in some way, and television is part of that. By the same token, I think one of the nice things that has happened is that, in part because of the cable channels and in part just because of a maturing medium, it's only 40, 45 years old in its largest sense, we have much far more options. the options that are there, I think, are the kinds of things that do allow for discriminating viewers to make choices. And my sense is that the medium is coming into its own now, and that perhaps we're approaching a better time in television than we've had in the past.
Steve, do you agree with that?
Yes. There's an awful lot of good stuff. I've never been one of those who says, oh boy, bring back the 1950s. Most of the shows were rotten then.
Yeah.
We tend not to perceive that now because we think back to the good examples, the Honeymooners or the Lucy Show and so forth. But there were also
Or the Steve Allen Show.
Well, thank you. But there were shows like Leave It to Beaver and shows that really were aimed at the 14-year-old mentality.
Mm-hmm.
14-year-olds are entitled to have their programming too. But my point is that there were not that many really great sitcoms in the 1950s. So today, ever since the day of All in the Family, which was really revolutionary, we've had a much higher quality of situation comedies, and now we have probably 8 or 9 that were really very well done.
Did television in the early days tend to want to teach and preach a little bit more than they do today?
I don't know. I did. How much people consider themselves taught or preached at, I don't know. But I've always felt that since I'm on television, I might as well use it for some purpose above and beyond making a living. And we were encouraged, those of us who worked at NBC, by Pat Weaver, who was then programming chief in the 50s. Mm-hmm. He sent around a form memo to all of us who were doing shows for him. I wish I'd saved a copy of it. But what he said, in effect, was, should it occur to you to put in a little culture, a little information, a little preaching, whatever the words were, please know that you will be encouraged to do that. We will not give you any trouble if you do that. I don't think you'd see such a memo today in the business.
Would you, PJ?
Yeah, in strange times. No, I don't think so. I think, as a matter of fact, in these days, perhaps because what has become controversial and what people want to speak about is now awfully more controversial. I mean, the Ellen Show this past season was an example of something that the network ABC felt pretty afraid at one point of putting on the air. Maud's abortion years ago on CBS. You know, one of the things going back to whether TV is better or worse than it was a few or at the beginning is that I suppose that actually there's more good stuff on television. But actually, when you look at the cable networks, a lot of what is on television there on the cable networks were things that were just actually 20 years ago able to be found on independent TV stations, like the old movies, like the old TV shows. Now they've been repackaged in a way that all of a sudden that old Leave It to Beaver that was kind of boring on WGN in Chicago is now a great thing on Nick at Night.
How worried are the networks of some of the new technologies and the new options that people have for entertainment and information, Horace?
I think that the worried may not be exactly the right term. They're certainly concerned, and they're certainly pushing ahead to invest everywhere they can. The conjunction of television and computers is something that has everybody confused at the moment, and the investments probably show that. But the fact that the investments are coming from the other side, that Mr. Gates is investing in various forms of television delivery, is an important aspect of the whole thing. And that, too, comes back to the notion of what's on the air. I think, ultimately, my view of what television is like is that we're moving toward a time when television is like a library. That people, if in fact we move to the situation in which we can deliver over the internet digitally, we can get television from France, we can get television from Japan, we can get television from the American 1950s, and people will be able to pick and choose, assuming they have the access to that kind of technology.
Are you concerned, everybody responds to this, I mean, once upon a time television was also that flickering light that everyone could gather around. As things get broken up, are you concerned that there really is not this unifying medium that can necessarily bring together people at times of national tragedy, whether it's a Challenger crash or a presidential assassination?
Yes, I think, oddly enough, that in those instances, when there's a true tragedy or a catastrophe, everyone does gather around, because at least during the, let's say, 4.5 hours on a given day when some catastrophe is being covered, there's nothing objectionable to children, except to perhaps the intrinsic violence.
Steve, excuse me for interrupting. We do have to break for a commercial. You know about that. We'll be back with your thought when we continue. I'm Bruce Dumont from Beyond the Beltway. Thanks very much for joining us tonight from the Chicago Cultural Center. From the Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Chicago Cultural Center, I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Steve Allen, you were making a point before we had a break for a spot.
Well, the point was that except for catastrophes, which do tend to make us all gather around, or special events such as World Series or Super Bowl games, that sort of thing, you could no longer put grandma and the kids and everybody in between on the couch and have them stare at the set, partly because of the vulgarity problem. And this relates to the fact that the networks, the three major networks, are losing a percentage of audience, and a hefty percentage, every year. They're losing it not because people are selling their sets, but because they're going to the alternatives. And much of the alternative popularity has been occasioned by vulgarity and obscenity and sometimes near pornography. So unfortunately, the networks then see these figures. They run them through the same computers, and they think, well, maybe we'll have to, if you can't lick them, join them, as the saying goes. So that's one of the reasons you're seeing more vulgarity of the most tasteless sort in prime time when children can watch it, early evening when children can watch it. And I think most people deplore that. I hope they do anyway.
Well, who are the people then that don't deplore it? Because obviously there are some people that are watching it. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering if an executive who has made a decision, whether it is a sponsor of a broadcast or a network president, I mean, does that person, do they get any peer pressure when they go down to the club?
A lot of people say they deplore it. A lot, you know, there aren't that. I don't think there's that much great evidence that says that they really do. And I'm more in Steve's camp than the other. I think that there's a lot of television cleaning up that could be done. But I think one of the things that happens is that, at least I've heard this is true, and I think this is true, is that daytime soap operas, for example, have been more risque for years than prime time ever was. Part of the excuse that was used was that most of the people watching soap operas in the daytime were women at home alone. They didn't have to get bothered for anyone but themselves. Now a lot of television viewing is done even in prime time in solitary ways. When I was growing up, you watched television with your family in the living room. That doesn't really happen anymore. You know, one son or daughter is in the family room, somebody else is in their bedroom, and we all do sort of watch TV sort of as individuals anymore.
And hardly anybody has dinner together.
Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I think that people are not turning to somebody next to them and saying, oh, dear, I didn't want you to hear that, or, Sonny, you should go into the other room, because he's already in the other room, probably watching something filthier.
By the same token, though, I think that there are people who turn to one another and say, mm-hmm. I can't believe they're doing that. Mm-hmm. In my time zone at 7:30 in the evening, and
absolutely.
And particularly, and the tastelessness is of a different sort. As a longtime soap opera viewer and aficionado of at least one soap opera,
all my children.
Pardon?
All my children?
No. One of the stodgier NBC soaps, Another World, okay. Which my wife and I have watched since we date from the time that our daughter was born, so it's now 26 years. We followed Mac and Rachel, but Mac died, and the actor died, and I wept. And so, but the kinds of scenes on daytime soaps, there have always been bedroom scenes. There have always been innuendos about whose cousin is married to whose uncle and this kind of thing. But that's very different from what's going on in the sitcoms at night, I think. Now, there's another way to talk about.
Let me ask you one question, though. When you say that, you know, you may be talking to your wife about, oh, you know, why is it going this far? Yeah. Are people at this point in time, are they infuriated enough where they're going to pick up the phone or write a letter to a sponsor or to a network? And if someone gets through to NBC or CBS or ABC, is it some, you know, 22-year-old guy in guest relations that's just saying, well, okay, they didn't like this show, they didn't like this show? Does anybody really care who can make a decision on that?
No, I don't think. I think.
Did it happen in your day, Steve?
We got a little mail, but never for vulgarity. There was none. No, you never saw anything vulgar.
If people called in and complained,
yeah.
In the late 50s and early 60s and through the 70s, I mean, did that send the fear of God through a lot of the network executives?
To a degree. That's why I encourage people to write now. One letter means no more than one vote. But if nobody voted or nobody wrote a letter, it would be a very bad situation. So I encourage people, when they see something that is really disgustingly vulgar, some executive is responsible for that, and some sponsor, some actual man with a name. Just find out who's the CEO of whatever company that did that. I did that recently. I saw an incredibly tasteless, really disgusting commercial for Grey Poupon mustard, which is a marvelous, you know, food product. But if you can believe it, the I won't go through the whole thing because it's a lot of people who may be having lunch at the moment. But the alleged humor of the commercial had to do with the fact that when one of the characters squeezed the plastic bottle,
it
made it sound like flatulence.
Yeah,
now, that is revolting.
Yeah.
And I'm no saying that you don't have to be. Even a sinner like me finds that disgusting. So that means more than if Billy Graham or Mother Teresa find it disgusting. You see my point. So my office found out who's the CEO, and it's one of the big companies, General Foods or General Mills or whatever. I wrote him a very stern letter and got a rather stupid response, but I think it's good that he read my letter. Maybe if he got 19 such letters, he might not do that anymore.
But I think that that's more what television is these days, when what we are complaining about, I think, is probably crude or vulgar. It's not really dirty, per se. It's not so much a dirty joke. It's just not dignified.
Is it an attitude, though? I mean, let's move from humor to something that can be very serious, and that is a discussion of drugs. It seems to me that over the years, there has been more of a sort of a laid-back reaction to drug-related jokes. And then we went into a period when things got a little, tight about it.
Yeah, NBC,
but it seems to me that things are relaxing a little bit more, and that there are maybe more drug-related jokes that pass over network airwaves.
I don't really see that, to tell you the truth. I really don't. I see actually that there are more. I'm going to sound like such a blue nose, but I see so much more it's like sexual deviance jokes that go over now than used to.
They also go over on the front pages of papers because many of our politicians are engaged in allegations as a humorist, how would you deal with some of the jokes that are certainly and currently being told about the President of the United States, Steve?
Quite aside from who the president is,
right.
I felt the same for the last several presidents. I don't mean, are I not a marvelous fellow, but I wouldn't do some of the jokes that I hear. They show no respect for the presidency. I don't mind sex jokes, but they don't even show respect for sex. I happen to think sex is marvelous. Can't get enough of it. I don't know about you guys, but I still don't like what Howard Stern does. I was listening to a show recently in Los Angeles, a radio show, not Mr. Stern's show, in which two allegedly funny morning, talk guys had a caller on the phone, and the caller and the woman with him were apparently making love, to use a sweet term.
A morning term.
And I wish those shows would use that kind of language more than the language they do employ. But the approach to it, I can understand interviewing someone on that subject in sort of a clinical way, an analytical way, and occasionally perhaps even saying something witty, but that's not what was happening. These people were saying, okay, now, where's your left hand now? And, I think that is disgusting, and I don't think I am alone in so feeling. But it is so common now. In the old days, the FCC wouldn't allow that sort of thing. Now the FCC seems like a rather toothless supervisory group.
In looking at how decisions are made at the network level, again, first of all, where do network executives come from, and how do they go about staying in touch with what people really want, or do they only look at the ratings?
Well, they go down to the farmers market by CBS, and they do testing of people. They test shows that way. If you ever are in Los Angeles and want to see a sitcom, go to the farmer's market, and if you look real normal, they'll pick you out and they'll ask you to see it and see what you think of it. But, they come from all over the United States, but, then they live in Los Angeles, and they sort of talk to each other, and they also have to do a lot of stuff. They do a lot, they have to make a lot of sausage, a lot of programs are made quickly, and as a result, there's a sameness. And what works, I think, as somebody said, you just do it to death, right?
Cookie cutter. Put it on the production line at some point.
Right.
I want to continue our discussion. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Steve Allen, P.J. Bednarski, and Horace Newcomb join us in our discussion of television. When we continue, we will talk more about Horace's new book called The Encyclopedia of Television, the first book written on the history of television worldwide. We can do that when we continue from the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Bruce Dumont back at the Chicago Cultural Center. Thanks very much for joining us tonight on TV 38 and also Channel 25 in the city of Chicago. Joining us tonight around the table, we welcome Steve Allen, who is a member of the Chicago, a member inductee into the Television Academy Hall of Fame, a member of the Museum Board in town for the celebration last Friday of the 10th anniversary of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, a true living legend, author of numerous books, one of which is called But Seriously, in which he sounds off on a variety of issues, some of which we are talking about tonight on our program. Dr. Horace Newcomb also joins us. He has written a three-volume tome called The Encyclopedia of Television, over 1,000 original essays, 350 contributors from all over the world, and he is the curator here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. P.J. Bednarski also joins us. He is the editor of Electronic Media, which is one of the premier magazines which covers the business of television in the United States. We should mention for just introductions here, Horace Newcomb, as the curator of the Museum of Broadcast Communications, it was about 3 years ago that you and I first discussed the possibility of putting together a book like this. Tell us about the breadth of this book, and also broaden, if you will, in your response as to how American television has affected international viewers.
Sure, and but just for the record, let me clarify that I did not write the three-volume encyclopedia of television.
You gathered.
I gathered and edited the three-volume encyclopedia of television, and we were fortunate to have more than 300 writers from around the world working on the project. The scope of the project is to deal with programs, people, issues, topics, ideas, the kinds of things we've been talking about tonight, the whole issue of gender in television, the issue of violence in television, but also to look at individual programs. I chose some of the ones I wanted to write about, so I did the essay on Gunsmoke and talked about the way in which that kind of television program for 25 years dealt with some of the things we've been talking about, dealt with all the social issues and so on in the guise of a Western and so on and so forth. But many of the essays are from other countries. Because of the publication focus on the English-speaking world, we have heavy entries from the United Kingdom, from Canada and Australia as well. Most of my learning had to do with Canadian and Australian television, which is really quite remarkable.
You mentioned Westerns and Gunsmoke. Once upon a time, the network television schedule was filled with Westerns, and there was a lot of violence on Westerns, but I don't remember too many people complaining about all the violence on television then.
Actually,
yet, we are now hearing about it in recent years.
They complained a lot. They complained a lot about violence in television in the 50s. Not only,
I was too young, I wasn't listening.
You were watching.
You're violent at the moment.
Watching, that's right. Cap Gun.
But not only the Westerns, but programs like The Untouchables, of course, which drew heavy criticism. And a lot of it circulated around until the time of the Kennedy assassination. And there was a backlash and a response at that point at the networks backing off of some of the violent programming, but it came back. I think some of the differences between those programs and the ones that we look at now is that there was a considerable amount of violence, but nobody ever seemed to be dreadfully hurt by it after the end of the show. I'm not sure how many times Mr. Dillon was wounded on Gunsmoke. I didn't go back to determine that, but he rarely remembered the gunshots by the next week.
Do you think there's a connection between the violence on television and violence in society, PJ?
I think that there's a connection that that we perhaps have become used to seeing it. I don't know. I think that with somebody who is affected to the extent that they would see something violent on television and then go ahead and duplicate the act or something like that, I think that that person is probably fairly strangely bent to begin with, and they were going to do that anyway. But I think that we probably have become a little desensitized to violence because of so much television, or so much violence on the air. However, I would say that there's probably never been less violence on television than there is right now on commercial, on network television broadcast.
Steve, what do you think about?
Yes, I agree. The violence problem has shifted over to relate to motion pictures, because now with all the explosions and crashes and that sort of thing, you have more violence. But it's an ancient problem. There's plenty of violence in the Old Testament. Many passages of Scripture, you should not introduce your children to. It's simply too bloody, too violent. Talking about the killing of thousands of people and glorying in it, which is much worse than the killing in combination with the killing itself. There's violence in Shakespeare. So you're never going to totally, quote, solve, unquote, this problem. But there are elements of it that probably go too far and probably do impress some impressionable teenagers.
But in a free society with a medium that can communicate, I mean, can you put too much of a governor on what the people see as far as violence is concerned?
A little
bit. Or does it come back to what the market will accept?
As regards censorship, the bad part is when the government gets into it. It's never a totally happy situation. Even the censors must wish they had some other work. But there is some of it, and we need some of it. The networks themselves do some of it. And when you see a motion picture on a TV screen of an airplane, nobody ever got off the plane saying, well, it was a wonderful flight, but I missed those 12 seconds of nudity and those four filthy words that my cousin told me were in this movie. Mm-hmm. They never say that. They just enjoy the picture. Mm-hmm. So we're not really talking about serious infringements on creative freedom. Having a man go bang, bang right in another guy's face, what's so creative about that? That's there for shock value. Now, on the other hand, if you're doing a movie about the mafia, that's what they do for a living. They go bang, bang right in a man's face. So you can't do that movie without showing some of that. So it's an eternal balancing act.
I think it's also, it's much more related, as PJ said, I think, to the person who is receiving the message. Because with all the stories, certainly in the last several years, about, you know, if a child is 14 years old, they have witnessed something like 14,000 murders on television, which may be true, but that same person has probably witnessed 38,000 jokes. And we don't say, wait a minute, this person is going to be funny. I mean, some people are going to react to that and be funny, yeah. And other people are going to pick up a...
The soul society is too funny, don't you think?
Well, but I'm saying, would you agree? I mean, there's been more humor on television than violence.
Oddly enough, there has been a cause and effect relationship of that sort. Mm-hmm. In the 1950s, it's hard to believe now, but there were only about 50 comedians in show business. Now there are about 5,000 of them. So that's obviously...
Who call themselves comedians.
Mm-hmm. Or somebody does. Making a few dollars at it. And some of them get into movies and do very well. But that's really an explosive jump from 50 all on one little bus to 5,000.
I want to... On the subject of comedy, I want to get your reaction to David Letterman. For many of the people who are watching the show this evening, they will say, oh, you know, they watch Letterman. He's so creative. He does these things. Everyone around this table knows, and I will say it for them, that much of what David Letterman does and many of the things that Jay Leno does now that he's gone more into sketch comedy himself, their origins go back to what you did on the Steve Allen Network show on NBC and the late-night Westinghouse show. As someone who really was, sir, the pioneer of that type of humor, how do you react to the way that they're carrying on your act?
Well, there's an old song titled, It Ain't What You Do, It's the Way How You Do It. And I could make out a long list of fellas who have just grabbed and run away with routines that sometimes I personally wrote and performed 19 times before it ever occurred to them to do it. But I don't mind it in David's case, because from the very beginning, he has always made it a point to mention my name. He has reported that he used to watch my second talk show in the early 60s every night when he was going to college at Ball State in the Midwest, and he has reported saying then, boy, I'd love to get into television to do that kind of a show. They seem to be having such fun. So he got into TV as a weatherman, I understand, and soon got into the talk show field. So he does a lot of my routines, but I don't mind because he gives me credit. It's that simple.
But a long list of people who did not.
Yes, there are others who took at least as much and said, who, me, when the subject came up.
Was it ever discussed or did they ever acknowledge it privately, if not publicly?
I don't know. If they did, they didn't acknowledge it to me, so I don't really know.
I want to talk more about that. I know, PJ, you've got a follow-up question to that, and we will get to that when we continue. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight for this special television edition of Beyond the Beltway. Thanks for being with us. We will continue with Steve Allen, PJ Bednarski, and Dr. Horace Newcomb, publisher, and author, rather, of the Encyclopedia of Television when we continue.
web back. We continue. A reminder, every Sunday night from 7 to 9 on WLS Radio, 890 AM. This program is live. We'll take your telephone calls. Hopefully you'll be able to tune in, and we are here every week at this time on TV 38. And for those of you who are watching later in the week on Channel 25 in the city of Chicago, P.J. Bednarski is the editor of Electronic Media, and you were about to ask a question before the break.
Yeah, no, I'm thinking as we had the break, maybe it wasn't even such a good question. But I'm curious about when you talk about people ripping characters off or what your bits off, is that Robin Williams, when he first started, was such a sponge for material that he was accused of that also. And I think rather legitimately or sincerely said he didn't really mean to be doing it. He was just picking up so much of this stuff. Mm-hmm. Does that happen with comedians, do you think?
Yeah, there is.
He didn't mean to do it.
Yeah, there is some of that. And what often happens is something where the comedian himself is not at all guilty, mm-hmm. but a head waiter says, listen, I heard a great joke the other night. One year when Gene and I performed in Las Vegas, we had my mother in the act. It may seem like an odd thing to say, except she was a professional comedian, and we did her old act. It was great.
And there were only 50 back then.
If that was. But one of the little routines in her act came when she was reciting an old poem. The boy stood on the railroad track, and the drummer would go with his brushes, like a train coming. And a million years ago, she ad-libbed, "Don't get any on me," you know. And then it became a permanent part of her act, and always a big laugh. The night after we opened, Dean Martin did the same line in the same situation, so it could not have been an accident. But he did not see us because he was performing in another club at the same time. Some comedy writer probably made himself a cheap $25 by saying, hey, I got a funny bit of business, and Dean liked it, so he did it. Uh-huh. There's a lot of that over the years.
Sure.
One thing we've not discussed tonight, and that is television news. If you were to compare television news of 20 years ago and entertainment television 20 years ago to what we see and experience now, would you also agree that things are better now than they were 20 years ago?
Oh, I can't. I certainly can't say that. I don't know. I think they're very different, and I think they're qualities that are very high qualities that we have today. We had certain kinds of things in the old days. Obviously, the move toward performers as news readers, news so-called reporters is a I dare say I would use the word a shameful step in the news industry. And the period, we speak of the Murrow legacy, and that was far more than a legacy at CBS. It pervaded the whole industry. And I think at that time there was a sense that journalists were journalists. They were trained in certain ways and so on. Now, and it's very much part of what we've been talking about earlier, the whole rush for ratings, the decline in audience for the major networks means that everybody's scrambling, and as a result they try a little bit of everything. There's too much reliance on the pictures for international news. There's far much too much emphasis on disaster and the aberrant in news.
But are we in a situation where you have 2020 and you have 60 Minutes, which has been on the air for 25 years,
great
and
shows.
In the top 10. You've got Dateline NBC, which I believe is now five nights a week?
Whenever they can stick it on, they put it on.
You certainly have a commitment by the networks that could have gone sort of, trashy. I mean, they seem to be trying to at least to carry on and put up a good face insofar as investigative and at least dealing with issues that the people seem to be concerned about, even though perhaps it may not be the expanded 90-minute NBC white paper on Bosnia or Chechnya.
People will say that because there are all those magazine shows on there now, that they've now diluted, that it's hard to find the latest scandal to do. And if something really horrible happens to you, it's very likely you're going to get, this rush from people from Dateline and 2020 and 60 Minutes who are all going to come and grab you because they need it. Which is not to say that's not to negate your point, because they really are doing that. Also, those programs are much less expensive to put on for the networks than putting on the hour-long drama. And as network economies have changed, because they are losing that audience, they have to put on more of those shows to sort of sustain themselves.
Does that, however, create a false reality? Because at the core of most of those programs, there is a corrupt politician, there is a nefarious businessman, mm-hmm. and again, that's part of their formula, if you will. Does that create a false sense that maybe not all politicians are on the up and up, Steve?
I suppose so, but I still think those shows should be encouraged. I would like to see 57 shows like that. I see more moral message on, just to name one of the shows, 60 Minutes than I see in the average Pat Robertson telecast. They expose evildoers, and when they get into the tight close-up, they do that because they know the man's about to lie or to confess and and jump off the edge of the world. So I think those are important moral messages. But
so it perpetuates reality as opposed to a skewed reality.
Yes. Well,
I mean, you don't see many stories on 60 Minutes about an honest politician or about a businessman.
That's not news.
Right.
Good news is not news.
Right.
We're never going to solve that problem. Hey, Flash, Bob Hope is still married. You'll never hear an item like that. But if he ever got divorced, front page. So we're all looking for bad news. But I think, by and large, the networks are doing a good job with news and coverage of news events. I think the lousy stuff is often the local station, sometimes network-affiliated. I just came back from a TV convention in Canada where I read aloud part of a letter I wrote to a network affiliate news department in Los Angeles. The big item that they did four teasers for, like, don't, you know, turn that
don't
dial,
miss this
we
one.
Got it coming up after these messages, was, if you can believe it, the fact that Howard Stern was visiting Los Angeles, and it was an open and shut plug for his movie with a typical title, Private Parts. You know, we're supposed to giggle at the dirty stuff. And that's pretty dumb. So I wrote rather a stern letter to the person who was the head of the news department at that station. Got no answer, but as long as she got my letter, that's okay.
Morris?
Exactly. Local news is a disaster, I think, all over the country. And part of it is because, once again, the economics suggest that that's the profit center for the local station. And we had a recent case where an anchor person, I believe three or four additional people, an entire crew, went from Austin, Texas, somewhere in Canada, to do a week-long special series on how magic tricks are really done. And this came back, and it was not an expose. It was just a fluff piece.
How did the ratings turn out?
That's the lowest rated station in the market, so I'm not sure if they did any better with that. I didn't notice any blip.
Well, as Ron Majors, a now deposed or now retired, self-retired anchor at Channel 5 here in Chicago, WMAQ, pointed out on another television program that there was a lot of criticism of a show, of a segment that WLS-TV did called, I think, Killer Pantyhose. Now, I didn't see Killer Pantyhose, but that did turn out to be the highest-rated newscast of that week and helped them win the ratings that month. So people do really like to watch those awfully, awfully stupid things sometimes.
Could you?
It's not the news, but it is watchable, I suppose.
Could you explain to the viewing audience why network executives and advertising agencies believe that people of a certain demographic, either gender or age category, tend to be more important than others?
Well, I think this is a true answer, but I also think it is the smart aleck answer, is that many of the people buying the ads are that age. And they tend to like those programs. Those are the programs they want to buy because those are the programs they watch. And so that sort of helps the business along. Also, though, the business...
But you say they make the buys. So these are the buyers at the agency who may be in that demographic group.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
not have to present a piece of paper to a sponsor that says, this is where we're going to spend your money, and the person on the receiving end of that,
and
are they in the same demographic group, or are they older?
Well, they're older, but they will believe the information. But they also point out that, you know, younger people are more likely to change brands. They're not as brand loyal as older folks are, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's all changing as the demographics of this country are changing. It's going to be interesting to see in the next 10 years.
Do you buy that, Steve?
Well, yeah, there are economic factors. If they decide that young people are more apt to use a deodorant because a famous athlete does than a 50-year-old man would be, things of that sort. Young women will buy more hair curlers or whatever that old women will. That's one of the reasons why they're targeting that youngish audience, which in an economic sense is reasonable.
For we baby boomers. When we come back, we'll hear about your baby boomers. When we come back, we do have to pause again for some commercials. And when we come back, we're also going to take a look back at the first 10 years of the Museum of Broadcast Communications and hear more from our guests. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway.
Dumont back at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. As we mentioned a little bit earlier, last Friday night at the Chicago Cultural Center, we celebrated the 10th anniversary of the Museum of Broadcast Communications. That's what brought Steve Allen and his lovely wife Jane Meadows to town, along with Mike Wallace and Edie Adams and Barbara Billingsley and Betty White, people that have been good friends of the Museum of Broadcast Communications since we opened in on June 13th of 1987. And a very important part of that night was a 10-year video retrospective on some of the things that we've done. And at this moment in time, we're going to take a slight pause, as they say in television, and look back at the video presentation that we shared the other night. And we want to share it with you right now, and then back with more discussion.
Looking right at the camera here. Do that again. Take care.
Take again, Candy. Look this way, please.
Because of the following special broadcast, the programs originally scheduled will not be seen tonight.
Celebrate American culture.
Leave It to Beaver. Starring Barbara Billingsley.
Experience the sights and sounds that shaped our lives.
The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
See how broadcasting has changed us.
Almost 1,500 Americans had been killed in Vietnam. Defense Secretary McNamara.
Remember the moments that made us laugh.
I must say it's marvelous to have you, Miss Moore, if you don't mind my just saying this right out. You're a wonderful person.
How true.
Moments that made us cry.
Now the caisson is just pulling out of the northwest gate, turning left onto Pennsylvania Avenue. And the riderless horse is behind it, being led by...
Moments that brought us together.
Velocity 2,900 feet per second, altitude 9 nautical miles, downrange distance 7 nautical miles.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications at the Chicago Cultural Center, preserving historic broadcasting moments since 1987. The museum collects and preserves classic moments from radio, television, and advertising.
America, away from breakfast, love with the
mayor. What are you doing here?
I finished washing your car, Mr. Bell.
The Timex watch on that propeller, let's lift her out, has been slashed through the water on that blade to the tune of 4,500 revolutions per minute. What a test for a waterproof...
Feeling mighty blue. Read my Nielsen and my Trendex, too.
The Nielsen Research Center contains over 75,000 hours of programming and commercials. And the museum has produced the highly acclaimed Encyclopedia of Television, the definitive work, the reference book of first record for global television history.
And you cannot get in unless you have so much representation, so much input, so much experience.
The NBC explores media's impact on society with its seminars that educate and entertain.
Laugh all through this program at Senator McCarthy. They can't believe that anybody took it seriously.
He also said that Hollywood just doesn't create enough good roles for women. But an exhibit in Chicago shows that women may have fared better on TV.
In Life with Elizabeth.
Classic tube rock moments have never been methodically collected in one place until now.
You're in the
baby, baby, word in our love.
We don't love to change the world.
The Television Exhibition Gallery presents hands-on chances to explore history. The Crane Center houses the Advertising Hall of Fame, which showcases the pivotal role commercials have played in defining television and radio.
Aren't you glad there's one company that can keep up with it all?
You got a deal, good. I'm putting you down to deal with Dick. Dick, what's the deal with the deal? Are we dealing? We're dealing. Dave, it's a deal with Don, Dork, and Dick. Dork, it's a deal with Dave, Dick, and Dave. Don, it's a Dork with Dick, Dave, and Dick. Gotta go, Dave, disconnecting. Gotta go, Dick, disconnecting.
And in the Kraft Television Center, visitors can step into the spotlight and experience the thrill of being on the air.
Would you like to sit at a desk like this and anchor news on television sometime? Now's your chance to try.
Commercial break, I need you guys to look
in. At Chicago's Museum of Broadcast Communications, MBC for short, you can make a tape of your very own using a script already prepared, read off the teleprompter, News taped sports and weather reports, news tapes, and, of course, commercials. MBC supplies the set, the cameras, the jackets, even the technical people and the floor director. You supply the talent.
Visitors to the museum's Radio Hall of Fame can relive radio's golden age.
The Bob Hope Show.
Gentlemen, this is Bob broadcasting in the Stockton Airfield Hope.
Jack Armstrong, the all-American boy.
Oh, no, McGee, no, not the very first time
Commanding officer, Uncle Ned.
Hi, pilots.
Hugh Downs, do you have a little briefing for the pilots?
I sure have, Uncle Ned. Pilots, if you haven't joined the squadron yet, you'd better do it today.
Live from Chicago, it's the 1993 Radio Hall of Fame Award.
Special events celebrate industry pioneers.
What Cooperstown is to baseball, Chicago is to broadcasting. This is where Major League Radio began.
Finally tonight, birthday greetings to an old friend. Radio, 75 years ago tonight, radio station KDKA in Pittsburgh went on the air to report the presidential election returns. Broadcasting was born, and the rest is history. Reported by correspondent Anthony Mason for tonight's Eye on America.
The Chicago Ballroom, the Museum of Broadcast Communications, marked the occasion.
Celebrating radio's 75th anniversary.
By gathering some of America's most familiar voices.
Live broadcast to faraway places bring vitality to the Lynn Angel Harvey Radio Center.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our weekly Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. Tonight's program is coming to you from our home base, the Radio Hall of Fame at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thanks for joining us tonight from coast to coast. Phone lines.
We are in 1949 with television coming in. You hear people say that things are so up to date. It's only when you look back. Only when you look back.
Hey, hey, he did it! Ernie Banks got number 500!
And Dennis hurries in, leaves it for Bobby. Shot!
Oh, 600! National Hockey League goal! Oh, here comes Spoon!
Good politics, and good politics is good government. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
And think that it was just a snowfall. But the snowfall is gone, and the people still came out.
Chicago is one city. We must work as one people for our common good and our common goals.
Hi.
Richard M. Daley.
Richard M. Daley.
Do solemnly swear.
Do solemnly swear.
We're gratified to learn that Chicago will soon have a proper museum of broadcast communications. As one who learned his craft as a broadcaster in the Midwest, I feel a personal involvement in your work.
The Museum of Broadcast Communications, a world-class institution, celebrating the past and looking forward to the breakthroughs of the future. Broadcast Communications, on the air in Chicago, and now, the world.
And that was the video that was shown Friday night at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. And some real good friends of this museum, Sedgwick Productions, Rich Christian, Rich Carra, and the whole Christian family, and Ted Elias, TMK Elias, and also Ken Nardine, one of the best voices, all donating their services as they have for many, many years. And I want to publicly thank them for that. And Steve Allen, you know, you may not recall this, but one of the very first times we met, you shared a story. This was long before there was a museum. You shared the horror story of what happened to the first years of The Tonight Show. Would you briefly share that with the audience? Because that was part of an inspiration for wanting to create a museum here in Chicago.
Well, I was the host of the show for 4 years, three local and one local, the rest network. And a lot of people say they'd like to see those now, and I would too. Unfortunately, the fellow in charge of the network's storage facility in New Jersey discovered he was running short of shelf space. Why, it never occurred to him to call up Sid Caesar and say, "Sir, would you like to have about 900 of your old show, or Milton Berle, or myself, or anybody else?" I don't know, but he didn't. He simply began to burn, literally burn, throw into the flames all these old kinescope films, and he burned probably 98% of my 4 years, and they also wiped clean a lot of the tapes of Jack Parr and Johnny Carson. So there was a lot of that destruction. That's why we need museums such as this.
Well, I thank you very much for being an inspiration and also being a good friend of the museum since its very beginning. And I know Horace is someone who is not only concerned about the history of television, but also looking to its future. Having heard this discussion, are you optimistic that that television will continue to be a significant portion of our lives, not only in the United States, but around the world?
There's no question about that. It will be changed in form, and so much of what we've talked about tonight really does rely on this shift from television as a central unifying medium that everyone in families, communities, and nations shares, to yet another form of communication that can be arranged and picked and chosen on a more individualized basis. And that's a huge shift. But there's no question that what we call television, I think, will continue to be here with us for a long time.
Well, I want to thank you again, because I think the encyclopedia really represents a roadmap that we can look at as we chart the future, not only of this museum, but also those who can come down and experience not only the archives, but also the fine words that you and your colleagues from around the world have put together in putting the Encyclopedia of Television together. P.J. Bednarski has been our guest. P.J., thank you very much. Editor of Electronic Media, thank you very much for your support, the support of the Crane family in our first, 14 years. We've been open for 10 years, but thank you very much for your support. And also, we'd like to thank Steve Allen. Steve, thank you very much for being with us. Member of the Television Academy Hall of Fame. He was in town for Friday night, and again, he is a true living legend, and he is author of the new book called But Seriously. And as we mentioned, also with us, Dr. Horace Newcomb, curator here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications from the University of Texas, and he is the editor of the 3-volume Encyclopedia of Television. It is available for your review here at the Museum of Broadcast Communications, and if you'd like to buy a copy, well, we'll sell you a copy too. Price $300. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. We'll be back next week at the same time. Until then, good night from Chicago.